Welcome back to the Roundtable. Growing up, Patricia Kashian felt most at home in the swamps and culverts near her home in the Hudson Valley. A child who frequently felt out of place, too much of one thing or not enough of another, she found acceptance in these settings among other amphibious beings, in snakes, snails, and above all, fungi. She saw her own developing identities as a queer, neurodivergent person reflected back at her, and in them, too, she found a personal path to a life in science. She writes about this in her new book, Forest Euphoria, where she shows us this making of a scientist and introduces readers to the queerness of all the life around us. Nature, she says, shows us, is filled with the unusual, the overlooked, and the marginalized, and they have lessons for us all. Patricia Kashian is the curator of mycology at the New York State Museum, as well as faculty with the Bard Prison Initiative. And it's a pleasure to welcome Patricia to the Roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's really nice to have you on. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. This book came out early summer, right around Memorial Day, and I've been looking forward to having you on for some time, and I'm very glad that you're here. Give us a sense of what brought you to want to tell this particular story that also includes your story.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and getting a chance to talk about it. I came to write this book because I wanted to, I guess I had several goals. One goal was to use my scientific knowledge to confront, you know, biases that people may have about queerness and kind of reject the charge that's often made that queerness is unnatural. And I know from studying wildlife and particularly from studying fungi as a mycologist that all sorts of organisms have all sorts of ways of reproducing and behaving and existing outside of this kind of notion of the binary. So I knew that, I know that there's so much evidence for this in science that, you know, there are different ways that creatures reproduce. There are different mating patterns or different sexual genetic combinations that can be had. And all of this is just really abundant and diverse in nature. So I wanted to sort of push back against this idea that it is unnatural to be queer or to be, you know, outside of the heteronormative way of being. I also wanted to explore queerness in a sort of broader sense. I use the word to sort of understand organisms that exist outside of the norm and not just in a reproductive sense, but also sort of like what creatures we value in our society, what systems, biological systems we place value on and around, and things that kind of exist in the margins. Like, so I wanted to sort of explore how our sort of cultural perception informs our scientific thinking and informs how we sort of create meaning and create family and kinship around other species. So for me, understanding like how do some creatures perceive love from our society and why are others sort of banished? And then I guess the other thing I was interested in doing with this book is facilitating and giving people sort of a path towards deepening their relationship to nature. I have a theme throughout the book is sort of the way that nature has been a source of companionship and comfort for me through sort of all these personal trials and tribulations. And I wanted to sort of share that knowledge and those experiences with people so they might, you know, have some guidance around how to find relationship to nature, how to cultivate that sort of relationship with the idea that it can bring a tremendous amount of like peace and vitality and sort of comfort, particularly in a time of like great unrest and chaos.
I'm curious, as it's not like any of this is new when it comes to the natural world. It's the way it has been perhaps since the beginning, with obviously some evolution taking place. But my curiosity comes from given that that is often the starting point of why it is not more known and accepted?
Yeah, so when I guess I was, one of the things I do in the book is sort of explain how science as like a discipline functions, right? So in general, scientists, we are striving for objectivity. We're trying to observe the universe around us and ask questions about it and formulate hypotheses and gather evidence and synthesize that evidence so it can be communicated in a sort of standardized way. But of course, throughout that process, there are many sort of places where the human perspective, the subjectivity of the, you know, being human can sort of creep in. And ultimately, it's not a purely objective process, although that's what we strive for. And I, of course, am a scientist, and I'm very positive about the power of science, and it is a tremendously useful tool that I have a lot of respect for. But it can also sort of be, you know, because it's carried out by human beings, there are flaws in the process and flaws in the cumulative knowledge that is generated. So there are all sorts of instances where, like, cultural biases, like the lens that someone exists, sees the world through, that's sort of informed by their cultural conditioning and their society. There are so many ways in which that might, you know, interfere with your ability to see what's actually right in front of you. And so when it comes to queerness in nature, there's all sorts of ways in which, like, sometimes really significant biases have interfered with the sort of collection of data around this. And then there's sometimes it was a little bit more passive. It's just sort of missed, right? So I cite in the book a text called Biological Exuberance by Bruce Begamiel. It was published in 1999. And it's a huge compendium of all of these examples of, like, species that are queer or otherwise, you know, not heteronormative. And there's a lot of sort of, you know, there's an explanation around that sometimes scientists were simply trying not to see what they were looking at. So sometimes maybe scientists were observing a pair of, like, you know, penguins that were both male, and they were like nesting partners, and they were raising chicks together. And they might just be, the scientists might conclude, oh, well, they had no other options, or they were confused, or they, you know, they sort of like might try to work to downplay what is clearly sort of just an example of same-sex behavior. And there's so many examples of this throughout the literature where, like, observations were made, but then there was all these explanations sort of deployed as to why it's probably not exactly what it is. And then there's also these, like, you know, instances where conclusions, you know, the observations of queerness in nature were not published because the researcher feared that they would be retaliated against, or that they would be, derided for having some sort of agenda, right? There's sometimes it's in the sort of apparatus that science takes place within, like the publishing apparatus or the institution, that might prevent a scientist from making just objective remarks on sort of a plainly homosexual observation. So there's different ways in which science can kind of be affected by these biases. And then the result is that we just don't know that much about it now, because it hasn't been an incentive or a clear, like, sort of community of researchers engaging with this context. So there's a lot of explanations for that, but I think that there is continually more and more observations and records and publications made on the subject.
You write in the book, the chasm between human and non-human feels so wide in our culture, like such a fraught gulf. It can be hard to imagine how things could ever be different, and it's impossible to comprehend how much has been lost. But these stories offer something beautifully instructive, what I would call a theory of species mind, an idea parallel to the theory of mind. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I think that one of the things that I deal with in the book is this idea of, like, human loneliness, right? And that's, I think, felt on an interpersonal level, but also, like, something a bit bigger, like on a more species level. And from my vantage, our culture, as I'm an American, you know, is one of like human exceptionalism, right? We have a pretty strong emphasis on the human perception of the world, the human entitlement to the world. Even, and this pops up even in scientific thinking, right, that humans are just so totally and wholly unique from all other species. And we reinforce that idea like subtly and overtly all the time, every day, by, you know, how we sort of interface with the rest of the world. This is, you know, through, and unfortunately, I think the most dramatic sort of display of this is in our wanton destruction of the earth and our extreme violence towards other species. So I think that there's this, you know, over time, over thousands of years, like I think accelerated by the Industrial Revolution and through systems of certain economic systems such as capitalism, we've created this, we've deepened that sort of divide. Of course, there are real differences between the human species and other species, but we have so much in common as well. We have so many similar needs. We have the same sort of, in some cases, very similar ways of sensing the world as a lot of other species do. And I think it's important to think about how deeply co-evolved we are with all these other plants and animals and fungi. Like, we really are made of the same stuff, right? And so I think that I wanted to sort of explore this idea of like, well, where does this idea of why is this idea of loneliness so pervasive? And I think it, to me, it's sort of obvious that we've created the loneliness intentionally in some cases by sort of killing off in our minds the things that connect us to these other species. And that killing off is sort of necessary so that we can kind of tolerate the damage that we're inflicting on others, because if we were to really feel it all, it would be unbearable. So in order to like sort of have this idea where we are the best and we are at the top, that facilitates our ability to extract from nature very gratuitously, to kill, to slaughter, right? We have to believe we're different. We have to believe we're apart from it. And that, but that comes at a cost, right? That cost is a sense of family, of community, and of sensing ourselves as like species in the mix of all these other species. And so I think it's a real crisis. It's like a psychological crisis that we've created. And it's that keeps climate change going as well.
Patricia Kashian is our guest. We had some technical difficulties and lost the phone connection, but I think we have Patricia back. Welcome, Patricia. You're there?
Thank you.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, I'm here.
The name of the book is Forest Euphoria, The Abounding Queerness of Nature. We were talking about your own journey and your learning in this process, which I guess obviously is a slow evolution, but something that through further study ultimately led to the book.
Yeah, so I would say that my self-understanding was sort of slow to develop. You know, I didn't have language for a lot of the things I was experiencing when I was starting as a young child. And it wasn't actually really until I was in grad school studying mycology that I started to grasp really like what it was to be a queer person and what these different experiences that I had during childhood sort of meant. And I definitely had this experience where in studying fungi and seeing their tremendous biological diversity and seeing how they sort of existed outside of real containable boxes and how they had all of these different strategies for existence and for reproduction and all of these things, I started to like understand my own queerness sort of through studying the biology of other species. I started to see that like things are actually much more plastic and flexible and fluid and like amphibious than, you know, we are taught as people in this society. So not to say, of course, there are some key differences between humans and fungi, but there are also, like, when you dig into the scientific process of understanding both groups, you see that things are, like, we often strive for clear boxes, and often those boxes are just not really comprehensive enough to understand what's going on. So, we use science as a tool for, you know, understanding different functions and systems, but often like things are quite a little bit messier and more complicated than that. And so I sort of, as I was becoming a scientist, I also felt sort of empowered to understand my own queerness in a similarly sort of expansive way. And that became sort of a very helpful and unexpected outcome of getting a PhD in biology.
What do you hope people take from the book and understanding?
Yeah, I want people to feel that they are part of nature, right? So I want one of the major takeaways, I hope, is that when people see themselves in all of their complexity and all of their messiness, that they don't feel alone, that they feel that they can see themselves as part of this tremendous, evolutionary explosion of life, and that there's so many ways to be a person, there's so many ways to be an animal, to be alive on this planet. And so I'm hoping that for people who maybe grew up feeling alienated for whatever reason, maybe most directly for being queer, but also for in any regard, if you feel like apart from sort of mainstream society, that you might find comfort in like all of this abounding queerness around you and all of these different, the diversity of form. And then also then to then, I think going from, from that closeness that, you might start to feel a greater commitment and a desire to be a steward of those other species, those other ways of being that maybe don't typically get advocated for, the less charismatic creatures. So that's sort of where I'm hoping, people might go with that.
Patricia Kashian is the curator of mycology at the New York State Museum, as well as faculty with the Bard Prison Initiative. The new book is Forest Euphoria, The Abounding Queerness of Nature. It is published by Spiegel and Graw. Patricia, thank you very much for sharing with us. I appreciate you being here. Be well.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And to you. Thanks so much. Again, the name of the book, Forest Euphoria. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.